Today on Maine Calling, Paul Revere's ride and a big birthday for the nation. If you're old enough, you remember the big celebrations in 1976 for the nation's bicentennial. Well, the semi-quincentennial is coming. The semi-quincentennial is coming. Doesn't exactly ring, does it? In any case, Friday is the 250th anniversary of Paul Revere's famous ride, which kicks off more than a year of national commemoration events. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will learn more about Paul Revere, his April ride, and his not-so-laudable role in an historic battle in Maine. We'll discuss the Revolutionary War and the contribution of Maine soldiers. And we'll find out about some of the events planned for this weekend and the next 2 years. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Verrill, committed to delivering trusted legal services in Maine and throughout the Northeast for 163 years. Learn more at verrill-law.com.
And this is Maine Calling. Most American kids first hear of Paul Revere's epic ride in grade school, and they likely read Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's poem about it. Well, that ride was 250 years ago this Friday. And of course, the real story is not so simple as the one we learn in elementary school. Today, we're going to discuss Paul Revere, the American Revolution, and the nation's semi-quincentennial celebrations. Yes, that is the word, the semi-quincentennial. My guest today, Tiffany Link, who is collections curator for the Maine Historical Society, and Major Jonathan Bratton, Maine Army National Guard historian, and he's on assignment to the U.S. Army in Washington, D.C. He's also the author of two military history books. Share your history questions and comments today. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to both of you. Tiffany, so many people, when they think of Paul Revere's ride, reflexively say, the British are coming, the British are coming. But that is one of the big myths, isn't it? Tell us the real story of Paul Revere's ride 250 years ago.
Sure. So Paul Revere probably didn't say very much during his ride at all, in fact. I think that there's a thought that if he had said the British, people wouldn't have known what he was talking about and would have been confused because they considered themselves to still be British. I think that that's probably not true. I think if he had said the British are coming, they would have known what they meant. You know, we have documents even in our collection pre-1775 that use the word Americans. During the Boston Tea Party, there were patriots dressed up as Mohawk Indians because they thought that that was a way to signify the fact that they were already considering themselves not part of the British in terms of their identity. So would they have known what he meant? I think that they probably would have. Did he say that? I don't think that he did. So what he probably said, if anything, is the regulars are coming. Or just calling for people to turn out. But during the first portion of his ride, he wasn't making a lot of noise or commotion because there were British patrols out on the road that night, and he actually had to avoid some of them pretty early on in his trip. There were a few houses along the way that both he and William Dawes, the other rider that evening, knew that they could stop at to kind of further spread the word. But Revere was the one that really knew that the British had actually already set out. When Dawes left the neck, it was a little unclear exactly what was going to be happening. So he didn't really start spreading information the way Revere had. But we know that Revere, you know, alerted a few houses along his way to Lexington. They say that by 5 a.m., even people in Rhode Island knew that the British were turning out that night. So okay. It was a pretty effective little spider web network that he was starting.
Okay. And you say the British were turning out that night. And Jonathan, I'll turn to you for that. You know, we've heard about the North Church and one if by land, two if by sea. And so what is it that exactly was happening? What did
people expect was going to happen and what happened. What does she mean by turning out?
Yeah, so there's this force of British troops, about 3,000 in Boston, that have been enforcing the shutdown of the Boston port. The Boston Port Act, passed the prior year by Parliament. This really affected every community along the seacoast, especially in Maine. You know, most of Maine's livelihood came from trading with Boston, both goods coming and going and food coming into Maine towns. So this shutdown causes this massive political flashpoint that's been building for over 5 years. Tensions are very high, and it's all, you know, with the Massachusetts Congress shut down that prior fall. Now there's this sort of limbo of what's going to happen. No one really knows what's going to happen next. I think it's always important to remind everyone that no one set out in April of 1775 to start a new nation. Maybe a few people were like, hey, independence could happen. But for the most part, there was a lot of what ifs. And a lot of the what ifs were contingent on what are the British regulars in Boston going to do? And General Thomas Gage in Boston is precipitate. His actions are very hesitant. He's been in North America for a long time. He likes North Americans. But on just a few days prior to April 19th, he receives a message from the Crown that says, hey, you got to do something about this rebellion in Massachusetts. You got to take some action. And so he takes an action. He sends out a force of about 600 to 700 British regulars to make a quick strike at Concord, the town of Concord, to seize artillery, ammunition, basically things that would be going to equip this New England army that's been formed since the last fall, and maybe snap up a few, you know, people like Sam Adams or John Hancock along the way. And so as the regulars are marching out, they're unaware that they're marching into this network of 14,000 Minutemen and militiamen that have been training since the previous fall.
Wow. Any of those militiamen from Maine?
They will be, as yeah. Tiffany mentioned. The message goes to Rhode Island by that morning. By nightfall on April 19th, the message has reached York and Kittery. And the next morning, April 20th, there's a company from York that's on the road to Boston. And when you think about communication, that's incredible. It's just an absolutely amazing communication network that they put together.
And Tiffany, take us back to 1775, April of 1775. Tell us about Mainers. Were they mainly revolutionaries, mainly loyalists? What can you tell us about them?
I think like other parts of the country, you know, you're probably divided into thirds, third supporting, third against, and third sort of neutral or trying to hedge their bets. You know, Falmouth or Portland is in a pretty precarious situation at this time. You know, as we already mentioned, they were kind of dependent on the Port of Boston for trade. They're really dependent on Britain for trade because under the colonial system, merchants aren't really allowed to trade or import with other countries. So the people on the coastal areas of Maine are a little more hesitant to join the war because their economic ventures are very much attached to Britain. People in more rural areas like Gorham or Windham or even Brunswick, they're a little bit more in favor of the war, and they've been stoking some, you know, patriot sentiment for a long time. You know, you have Thompson, the militia leader from Brunswick, who's causing a lot of trouble throughout 1775 in various places in Maine, which, you know, conversation for another time, but that will eventually lead to the burning of Falmouth in 1775 in October, following Concord and Lexington.
So down the road, later in this program, we're going to talk about Falmouth. We're going to talk about Castine. We're going to talk about Machias. But right now, I just want to come back to our little history lesson. And I want to ask you, Jonathan, about the next day. So April 18th is when Paul Revere and others, important to say, and others set out riding to let people know. That's overnight, April 18th to April 19th, 250 years ago. And then April 19th, which is this Saturday, is the Battle of Lexington and Concord. And Jonathan, what is important to know about that?
As I said earlier, no one's going out to begin a war immediately. If you look at the actions of the militia and the Minutemen, they really do their utmost to try to prevent conflict as much as possible. Everything from Captain John Parker with his Lexington Company of Militia positioning his soldiers on the green, not on the road, not blocking the regulars' route, to Colonel Barrett, the in command of the troops at Concord, ordering his soldiers, don't fire first. Whatever you do, don't fire first. It's this strong precaution. It's this collection of misunderstandings, then also just the buildup of so much animosity and anticipation, and also the fact that these British troops have been marching all night through a countryside that has alarm bell, you know, church bell ringing, musket shots going off, alarm fires burning, everyone's keyed up. And then the incident on Lexington Green, everyone is trying to be under control. Somebody somewhere fires a shot. The British open fire. There's really not much response from the Americans. It's almost this massacre. The British push on to Concord to begin their search, and that's where everything breaks down. The militia massing at Concord confront the regulars at North Bridge when they believe, the provincials believe the British are burning the town. And they are going to go intervene to stop that. And that causes the shot heard around the world. And then it's a day of running battle where by the end of the day, Massachusetts, at least, is very much, and by proxy, Maine, is very much at war with the British Empire.
And that's right. In case anybody doesn't realize it, of course, Maine was part of Massachusetts then and would not be its own state for quite a few decades afterwards. Joining us right now is Maine Secretary of State Shenna Bellows, who is part of Maine's semi-quincentennial commission. Thanks for joining us, Shenna. Secretary Bellows.
Thank you so much. It's great to hear this history, and we are so excited about America's 250th birthday.
So I know that the events start very soon. We're talking about Friday being the 250th anniversary of Paul Revere's ride. What are people around Maine and around the country doing on Friday, and what would you like to ask people to join in on?
So we are kicking off the commemoration of the 250th anniversary of the founding of our nation with an event called Two Lights for Tomorrow. That is a nationwide call to action, and we are doing that in Maine. And what it is using the imagery of that shining light, you know, the two lanterns in the Tower of Christ Church in Boston indicating that the British were traveling via the Charles River, using that imagery of the shining light as a uniting call to action for our fellow citizens, no matter where they are, to commemorate and remind ourselves that our history is about working together for a better future. So on Friday, April 19th, there are a few different opportunities to join celebrations either in the state capitol or around the state. So at 11:30 a.m. in the Hall of Flags at the state capitol, we'll be hosting, this is the commission, we'll be hosting a press conference, enjoying excerpts of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's poem, Paul Revere's Ride, and speaking about this history and our plans over the next year for these commemorations. And then at 7:30 p.m. that night, we'll be doing a lighting. I'll be shining two lights on the Capitol from Capitol Park. And we're encouraging anyone and everyone across the state, they can also display two lights in their homes, at visitor centers, at cultural, historical, and community sites, and in government buildings on Friday to commemorate the beginning of these efforts as a nation to work together toward a brighter future. And in fact, it's happening. From Portland to Presque Isle, there'll be events all across the state.
And a simple thing anybody can do is put two lights in a window.
That's right.
That's great.
And then
hey, I want to ask, I suspect this is the first of a lot of things between now and July 4th of next year. Want to tell us about a couple other events?
Absolutely. So the legislature established the Maine Semi-Quincentennial Commission. Yes, that is a mouthful. And it's a 15-member commission that has been working hard to develop and coordinate a series of activities, including educational and historical events and activities and programs across the state. We're one of 56 states and territories with a commission that's coordinating these activities. And we've employed or developed three foundational pillars. We want to connect. We want to unite Maine stories with America's legacy, foster a sense of community and shared heritage. We want to share, illuminating Maine's legacy and America's story, and provide engaging and informative programs just like this one to highlight Maine's role in American history and our larger national narrative. And then we want to learn. We want to examine Maine's role in our ongoing journey, our past, our present, and our future. And so one example of an exciting project is something called the Maine Atlas Project that we'll be kicking off this week as well, with funding and support from the Maine Office of Tourism. we will identify and promote 250 places, people, events, and objects that represent Maine's unique cultural, natural, and historical assets.
Great. And is there a place, is there a website people can go and learn about everything?
Absolutely. This is all on our website, the Maine Secretary of State website, and you can check it out at maine.gov/SOS for Secretary of State, /America250ME.
Great. And we will put that into our newsletter and on our website as well. Secretary of State Shenna Bellows, thank you so much for calling in. We are going to pick up the history lesson after the break. We're also going to take your questions. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Friday marks 250 years since Paul Revere's famous ride. We're learning about the history of that time in America and Maine. With me today, Major Jonathan Bratton, Maine Army National Guard historian, and Tiffany Link, Collections Curator with the Maine Historical Society. We invite you to join this conversation. Send us an email at talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now, John Babin, who is Visitor Services Manager for the Maine Historical Society and the Wadsworth Longfellow House and Garden. Hi, John. And you know what? I understand you are the expert on Longfellow's poem, Paul Revere's Ride. What is right and what is wrong in that poem?
Okay, so what people don't seem to understand about the poem is that Longfellow actually knew of Paul Revere's account of the ride that night. Paul Revere actually wrote a letter in 1778 for Jeremy Belknap, and he was the original founder of the Massachusetts Historical Society. And it was an account of what happened that night. We know that Longfellow knows of the account of that night because in the New England Magazine in 1832, that account was actually published. In that same publication was a poem written by Longfellow, okay? So Longfellow knew of the account, but he decided that he wanted to basically write a poem, and he wanted to write a poem that would basically make a hero of Paul Revere, okay? He felt at this time in national crisis that the children needed a hero that they could look upon. And so
What year did Longfellow write the poem?
1860.
Okay, great.
Yep. So it's 165 years old.
Wow. Hey, let me ask you if you would mind reading a few lines of the poem.
Well, everybody knows, listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. And it's amazing, as the visitor services manager here at the Maine Historical Society, how many people from all over the world, especially during cruise ship season, will come in and read those lines to me. So, you know, it's really something that, you know, after 165 years, people still remember this poem.
Why do you think it has such lasting appeal? I mean, Longfellow wrote a lot of poems.
Oh, yeah, he certainly did. Well, you know, the thing about this poem is that, you know, he wrote it in the midst of a national crisis, you know, that would break out into war a year later. And Longfellow was a pacifist and an abolitionist. And he really felt as though, you know, that something needed to be done, that somebody needed to speak out. And this would not be the first time that Longfellow would use his poetry to speak out against things like civil unrest. You know, in 1842, he wrote poems on slavery. You know, 1845, the arsenal at Springfield, the building of the ships, 1850, you know, to strengthen the Union. So this would not be the first time that Longfellow would use his poetry to speak out, but this poem in particular, he really wanted to create a hero.
Do you have a couple lines that are your favorites?
Well, so through the night rode Paul Revere, and so through the night went his cry of alarm to every Middlesex village and farm, a cry of defense and not of fear. Defiance and not a fear, a voice in the darkness, a knock at the door, and the word that shall echo forevermore.
Ooh, well done. You know, you've established that Longfellow wanted to make Paul Revere a hero. What in the poem is fictionalized? Maybe one or two things.
So the thing about Paul Revere is people don't understand. Paul Revere's ride, he actually did make it to Lexington, okay? And he was able to warn John, John Hancock and Samuel Adams, you know, of the British coming out. The thing about the poem is the redcoats are coming. He never said that. Paul Revere actually said the regulars are out, okay? The regulars are going to be out. So, you know, Longfellow, the thing about people don't understand about the poem is Longfellow was a poet, not a historian. And Longfellow wrote one time that he said, poets are like children. They exaggerate. So,
well, yeah, the regulars are out is not very poetic, is it?
No, not really. So, you know, but the thing about Paul Revere is he did make it all the way to Lexington. It was just Samuel Prescott and William Dawes that actually made it to Concord, you know. But a lot of it, you know, a lot of it is factual.
Well, John, I so appreciate you calling in, and I can't wait for another season of cruise ship tourists and others to come in and talk to you about Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you so much for having me, Jennifer. Have a great day.
Great. And before we get to audience questions, I want to, there's a few things about this history lesson that we have got to get to. And one of them is about Paul Revere, and I'm going to go to you, Jonathan Bratton. You know, America thinks of Paul Revere as a hero, but there's probably a few people in Castine who know that his reputation is not pure. What happened there?
Well, in short, he probably should have stuck to silversmithing and delivering messages, because as a military leader, he didn't quite make the cut. In 1779, the British occupy Maine as part of ongoing military operations, and they make a lodgment at Castine, begin building a fort. Massachusetts says absolutely not, and mounts this, you know, basically just a Massachusetts, largely New England-led expedition to go expel the British from Castine. And in there is Paul Revere as one of the commanding officers, and. The expedition is an absolute failure. One of the worst military disasters, basically loses most of the Continental Navy, ends up with everybody just sort of having to walk back from Castine back down to Cumberland County, York County, and the rest of Massachusetts, which sounds awful. And in that process, Paul Revere's reputation takes a major blow. He is actually going to be court-martialed by Massachusetts for it. The court will exonerate him in later years. But yeah, that's he was a great alarm rider, wonderful silversmith, great at telling the American story. Just don't put him in command of troops.
All right. And silversmith, I know that the City Hall bell in Bath is a Paul Revere bell, but there are others as well, right? Do either of you know the answer to that? No? Okay. I'd heard that. I know about Bath, and I thought that there are others as well. Maybe one of our audience members knows. Tiffany, I want to talk about two other things that are important, Maine's role in the Revolutionary War. And of course, one was the burning of Falmouth, as you mentioned before, which Falmouth at the time was Portland.
Correct, yes. So there's a lot of things happening in 1775, not just Concord and Lexington. As news of Concord and Lexington is reaching Maine in April 20th or 23rd, there are some things going along around the coast with the militia. There is a great effort to sort of enforce some non-importation agreements, essentially boycotts throughout the colonies. Captain Mowat is going up and down the coast. He is trying to enforce some new orders from Admiral Graves that say that he can burn any towns east of Boston that are in support of the revolution, or the insurrection. Maybe it's not a revolution at this point yet. And so he has a list of towns, like Falmouth is one of them. There's also Salem, Marblehead, Machias, Booth Bay. And so he sort of starts heading up the coast. He passes up a couple of different towns. There is an engagement at Machias that doesn't go very well. That results in a Patriot victory that is really kind of sticks in the side of the British. Mowat himself is kind of gets stopped at Booth Bay because there's some really bad weather. And so he turns around, starts to head back down the coast, but stops at Falmouth before he goes back to Boston and lets them know that he's going to burn the town, that they have an hour to get out or to save what they can. And they negotiate with him because they've had some encounters with him before. And they ask him for a little extra time. He says, you have until 9 a.m., or you can turn over all of the city's guns. Again, this is October, so we all know that they're kind of trying to curtail weapon collections among the town so that they aren't able to resist the British troops. So he asks for all of the town guns. They say, you can't really find them all, but here's 10. here's 10 arms, give us a little bit more time. And so he says, well, if you can get back to me, I'll give you a little more time. And this is happening 9 o'clock the next morning. And so he gives him about 40 extra minutes, and then he opens fire on the town because he hears nothing else from the town council or the militia leaders regarding this negotiation. And over the next 6 to 9 hours, he essentially burns the town. He fires on it with cannonballs and incendiary shot. And then, when that hasn't quite destroyed things to his satisfaction, he does send some troops into the town itself to set fire to some of the remaining buildings and essentially destroys the whole peninsula, which would have run from that point kind of to the Eastern Cemetery over to maybe like about State Street. It was pretty concentrated. There were about maybe 2,000 people in town, 150 families or so. And most of it was fairly flat, sort of sloping down towards the water. It was really easy pickings compared to some of the other coastal locations that he could have chosen to attack with those orders.
Yeah, and Jonathan, Tiffany mentions that Mowat had gone up and down the coast and that something happened at Machias. Is that what's known as the Margareta Affair?
So Machias is basically just one big giant flashpoint. I mean, it is everyone who doesn't like the British eventually ends up there. It's this sort of really fascinating link of, upset Nova Scotians that come south to settle there eventually. There's a bunch of Wabanaki Native Americans who are friendly to the cause who sort of settle around Machias. And you have this burgeoning little like bubble of rebellion that the British just don't really know what to do with, and it's just always annoying them. So you have it begins in May, June 1775, much like what Tiffany was talking about with Thompson in Falmouth. It's this sort of a bunch of characters who knew each other prior to the war, to the breakout of hostilities, and who are just sort of trading so on opposite ends of basically economic agreements, who decide to use this moment to sort of vent some steam, if you will. And this gives rise to the Battle of Machias, the seizure of the British ship, the Margareta, often called the Lexington of the Sea. This is the beginning of the problem of Machias. Machias will go on to continue to be a problem, embarrasses a whole bunch of British naval vessels in 1777 with the Battle of the Rim, which is celebrated by Maine's Wabanaki community as Penobscot, Passamaquoddy, Mi'kmaq, Maliseet all took part in this defense of Machias and the repulse of this small British fleet. Very embarrassing for them. But yeah, Machias has this very interesting history throughout the revolution in Maine, that really encapsulates so many of the issues of a divided state.
Thank you for that. We're going to go to some calls now. We're going to go to Julie calling from Litchfield. Hi, Julie, go ahead.
Hi there. I serve with the Maine Ulster Scots Project and am the chair of the Sestra Centennial Planning Committee. And our organization collects and uncovers the migration stories from the north of Ireland through genealogy, public outreach, archaeology, and research. We are sponsoring events and promotional activities that are focused on the 250th related campaigns, skirmishes, battles, and expeditions that occurred in the District of Maine spanning from 1775 to 1779. So, in order to celebrate 250 years of American independence, we are honoring Maine's Scots, Irish, American Revolutionary War patriots. And our first big event is on Saturday, April 26th. It will occur in Yarmouth, and we are showcasing 20 first and second generation Ulster Scott immigrants to Casco and Merrymeaning Bays at this Patriots Day program in celebration of Patriots Day. Many of those immigrants enlisted and mustered from Yarmouth immediately following the battles of Lexington and Concord. And we have one event, two venues. We have a lecture portion from 11:30 to 12:30 at the West Custigo Hall and Community Center. And our speaker is John Mann, who is a co-founder of Maine Ulster Scots Project, and a professional surveyor and historian, and he will talk about the Scotch-Irish Rebellion. So for those in your audience who may be of Scottish, Irish, or Ulster Scots heritage, they may be interested. And following that, we'll have a reception and social hour at the North Yarmouth Old Townhouse.
Julie, I'm going to ask you a favor. Would you or somebody from your organization go onto Maine Calling's Facebook page and post information about the events? I think that would be very helpful for people who are not listening with a pen right now. So Julie calling from Litchfield, thank you so much for calling. We're going to go to Rob calling from Woolwich. Hi, Rob. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? I'm calling about the Arnold Expedition, which happened in September of 1775. When 1,100 soldiers left the siege of Boston, sailed to the Kennebec River to Fort Western, and then went up the Kennebec with 44 tons of equipment, carried their boats 13 miles over a mountain, continued on, carried over other things, and then went down and got to Quebec City in November. They'd been eating their shoes and eating their belts and going practically naked and shoeless by that time. And they attacked Quebec City, and they lost miserably.
Yeah, Rob, thank you for bringing that up. Jonathan Bratton and Tiffany are both smiling here. Tiffany Link, both smiling. Jonathan, I understand that kids in Quebec City, they know all about the Arnold Expedition, that's a big part of history there. What do you want to add to what Rob's told us?
I think the Arnold Expedition is sort of amazing because it's a sort of a who's who of the American Revolution that goes through Maine. You know, Rob did a great job of outlining just the sort of utter horrors. I recommend Tom Desjardins' book on Through a Howling Wilderness on the expedition itself. But Aaron Burr is on that expedition, future Vice President of the United States. Daniel Morgan is going to go on to be this great Continental leader. You've got all sorts of people, Henry Dearborn, who will eventually be Secretary of War. They unfortunately eat Dearborn's dog during the expedition, which just shows how bad things are. But it is this really remarkable thing. It does not come off well. Our invasions of Canada throughout that war and the next are all just miserable failures. But it's another piece of what makes up this kind of amazing tapestry that Maine is the frontier. Maine is this piece of meeting of cultures, of English, of French Canadian, of Wabanaki, of rebellious English and loyal English in Nova Scotia. And it's sort of this amazing focal point for so many different people.
Rob, thank you so much for calling. And Tiffany, as I'm listening to this, I'm thinking about history and how we remember and what we learn and what we don't learn. And that's a big part of the work that you all do at the Maine Historical Society, right? Is sort of digging in and saying, well, there's more to this.
Absolutely. And I think the Arnold March is a great example of that because it's something not at the forefront of most people's minds. It was a failure. So I think that's probably why it doesn't get talked about very much. But we actually have Arnold's letter book detailing the expedition in our collection, and you can view that on the Maine Memory Network. It's his account of what's going on, and he's writing back to Washington, and he's keeping copies of his end of the correspondence throughout that venture, which is very arduous and in many ways is a lot of more rural Maine's first encounter with the war. There's 1,000 soldiers marching through towns of like 10 or 15 people. they're going through Skowhegan, they're trying to go up the Kennebec, they're following this path that French and Indigenous explorers had established around 1760 or at least confirmed that it existed to get from Quebec to the coast. And the Americans were very afraid that the British were going to start using this path themselves. And so that's why there was this rush to start this expedition in September, which is a terrible month to start walking through the northern Maine wilderness, especially with 1,000 men and food and supplies and oxen and boats that you're having to carry on your back half of the time. But they were in a real rush to try to cut off what they thought might end up being a very viable supply route, although they quickly figured out that they probably didn't need to worry about that in the end. But it's one of the things that kind of sets Arnold up as this person who's willing to take great risks, who seems extremely dedicated to the cause. And then, of course, kind of after that, he gets on a trajectory that doesn't lead him to a great place in the end.
Which is the subject of another Maine Calling show. Jonathan, from look on your face when Tiffany Link said that they have Benedict Arnold's letters posted online, I have a feeling I know what you're doing this afternoon.
Absolutely. There are not that many primary sources from the Revolution. As a primarily a 19th, 20th century historian, I get so excited when you find like a letter book or an orderly book, because there you're actually seeing what these people themselves wrote at the time, rather than what someone, you know, in the 1820s said, oh, I heard somebody say this, and then they write that down as history, which is unfortunately a big piece of the problem of studying the American Revolution. A lot of it is in the light of, hey, we have this country, versus we don't know what this country is going to look. We don't know if we'll have a country. We don't know what we're British. We're not sure what we're doing right now in 1775. So I think it's always good for us to remember how valuable those things are and why Maine Historical is so fantastic, such an amazing resource.
And we are in the middle right now, of a project to digitize manuscript from the war, both at our repository and other repositories. So we're working on compiling those and digitizing them as we speak to go on the Maine Memory Network as part of an initiative for the war. And the Arnold Journal is just one of them. And to your point, there were so many famous people, future famous people on that expedition. And Aaron Burr is actually the one who orchestrated getting that journal to Maine Historical Society when it became available. So there's a lot of names that come up, but that's just, you know, we're digging through a lot. We're going through our collections. We are sussing out the stories and the legends and the lore that get attached to all things revolution, the sort of cult of the revolution. And as we're preparing for our exhibit next year, we're really sort of trying to separate the legend from the truth. And sometimes it mixes and sometimes it doesn't.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we do have to take another quick break. We are talking about Paul Revere, the American Revolution, Maine, and the semi-sesquicentennial of the United States. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. What is the story of Paul Revere, the American Revolution? How is it viewed now, 250 years later? Yep, Friday is the 250th anniversary of Paul Revere's famous ride. Joining me for the hour, Tiffany Link with the Maine Historical Society, and Jonathan Bratton, Maine National Guard military historian and author. I should have said Major Jonathan Bratton. Share your comments and questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or call 1-800-399-3566. Jane is calling from the Maine Council of Churches. Hi, Jane. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks. I'm calling to let folks know that the council is an honor to be part of a national coordinating committee for an event called Black Freedom, taking place this Friday. And it's an opportunity for houses of worship all across the country to come together in solidarity against tyranny and for the soul of our democracy by ringing their bells. And it will coincide with an event happening at Old North Church at 6 o'clock Friday night, where Maine's own Heather Cox Richardson will be delivering a keynote lecture. And that will be live streamed actually on the Old North Church website. But there will be churches all over Maine participating in this event. And there are churches with Paul Revere bells. I heard you talk about that earlier. One of them is First Parish UCC in Gorham, and they will be ringing their Paul Revere bell as part of the Let Freedom Ring initiative. And it's not a Paul Revere bell, but it's kind of cool that at the Spring Point Ledge Lighthouse in South Portland, a group of Quakers and Christians will be gathering to ring that bell as a part of this event. And it's also Good Friday, So for Christians, it's a real coming together of the message of what it means for one person to stand up against tyranny, even at great personal cost. So we're very honored to be a part of this. And people can go on the website, letfreedomring.live, to see a list of the churches in Maine that will be ringing their bells that night.
And that's at 6 o'clock.
It will be for most churches, although for some they might be doing it a little earlier or a little later because it is Good Friday. There are services happening, so churches have had to kind of wiggle their schedule around to make it happen. And some churches that don't have bells will be hanging two lanterns as a sign of solidarity with the effort.
Thanks so much for calling in and telling us about that, Jane. Let's see, we'll move to Seth, who's calling from Rockland. Hi, Seth. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going, Jennifer? I just wanted to add to the Captain Mowat story, and there's not a lot of stories of Maine women during the Revolutionary War. And one of the things I've read about a few times is a woman named Alice Greeley. She was AKA the Widow Alice. And the story goes, as I understand it, that she owned a tavern in Portland, Falmouth, and during the shelling was on her roof with a cast iron pan, peeling the cannonballs out of her roof to prevent it from burning. And then that tavern became, for the rest of the war, the sort of primary meeting place of Falmouth because there was nothing left around. And I wondered if the historians knew that story and had anything to add, and or if there was any other women around the Revolutionary War in Maine that they might know other stories of.
Well, it looks like Tiffany is nodding. You know about the widow Alice Greeley?
Yeah, absolutely. Alice's tavern is well known. It's it was probably about where the old public house is, or where the main calling station is now. So sort of on the back side of the peninsula at that time, Cumberland Avenue would have been about where Back Cove would have come up to. So it was a little bit more sheltered and protected, and it did not burn. It was one of the few buildings still standing in town. The story about her being on the roof, you know, may or may not be true. A little embellished, a little bit of the Paul Revere sprinkle on that, perhaps. But there were people in town who were actively trying to put out fires. That's one of the reasons that Mowat sent his troops into town to kind of finish the job of what his cannonballs couldn't do. And they certainly used her tavern as a meeting place afterwards for the town council, because there weren't a lot of people left in town. They really didn't start resettling Falmouth until after the war, but they were still having town meetings here and making decisions, you know, regarding the town and also the war throughout the, you know, later 1770s.
So Tiffany, we don't know
certainly.
The exact location of where it was, but probably kind of near where Cumberland Avenue comes into Franklin Arterial now.
Probably closer to where Cumberland Avenue and Elm Street intersect. Yeah.
Oh, go ahead, Jonathan.
Well, I was going to say, just talking about women in the Revolution, I you know, talking about Machias prior
Anna
to the
Weston.
Battle. Yeah, and Rebecca Weston, you know, traveling 16 miles to carry a medal, essentially, to be melted down into ammunition. One of the things that we forget about when we talk about 18th century warfare is that there's no formal logistics for these armies. And in the Continental Army and in the militia, there is actually, and it will be formalized during the war, positions in the regiments for women to basically do the role of logistics, from laundry to making food, preparing food, to doing things that today we have special army units to do. But these were done oftentimes by women, and almost always behind the scenes. It's really one of these remarkable things of being so present and yet so invisible.
An email here from Kit. I don't know if anyone has spoken yet about Dr. Joseph Warren. He was an intricate part of the early planning efforts to oppose British actions on the colonists in Boston. A doctor by training, he took the lead alongside Samuel and John Adams. He was also the one that dispatched Paul Revere and William Dawes to go to Concord and Lexington with the news about the British. However, he's mostly unknown because he was killed at Bunker Hill. Most of his work was done in the planning, but on that particular day, he decided to join the fight. So Dr. Joseph Warren, was he from Maine?
No, he was from Massachusetts, from Roxbury. If you had a whole nother hour, I could talk about Joseph Warren probably until the world. but yes, he was from Roxbury. He was a doctor. He was an excellent doctor. He was sort of on the forefront of some smallpox vaccinations. And then he became a leader in the revolution in Boston, right up there with sort of Samuel Adams and James Otis, and sort of in those early days was really orchestrating the spy network in Boston, especially after the port had closed. And so it was to him that all of these reports were flowing throughout the 18th of what was going on with the British. And he had some, you know, predetermined plans with Paul Revere and William Dawes about who was going to do what, how they were going to get the word out when they needed to, because they knew that this was coming. The British had already tried to take some stores in Salem. There had been sort of smaller skirmishes. They knew that eventually something bigger was going to happen. And so their reports that were coming into them were that the British were going to march out, that they would be headed to Concord for these stores of ammunition. And they were really worried that they were going to capture Samuel Adams and John Hancock, who were attending the Provincial Congress and staying at Hancock's house in Lexington. That may not have been as high of a British goal as Joseph Warren thought it was, but that was their major concern. And so that was really Paul Revere's number one goal that night, was get to Lexington, warn Hancock and Adams. And then if you can keep going, you know, meet up with Dawes and keep going, that's great. But sort of alert the houses that we know along the way, start the spider web network of news, and get Hancock and Adams to safety. So that was kind of his big deal that night. And then, yes, he does also get out of the city himself and join the fight. There's a great story that he has this fancy clip in his hair and that a musket ball shoots it off. And he's like narrowly avoids death in Concord and Lexington. And then he is a general later on. He kind of doesn't accept the commission because there isn't time for the Continental Congress to get it to him officially. So he joins Bunker Hill kind of as an enlisted soldier, although everyone's looking to him for leadership, and is unfortunately killed there. But
we'll go to Stephen,
who's been one of the greats, you know.
We'll go to Stephen calling from Concord Township. And Stephen, we're tight on time, so we love that you're joining us, but if you could be quick, that'd be great.
All right, gentleman by the name of Rob Morrison down in Concord, Mass, has put together a contingent of every Concord in the United States. We're all supposed to meet Saturday morning down at the beginning of the parade. And that's where we're all going to be. I got my buckskins out, my moccasins, and I'm heading.
You're heading to Concord, Massachusetts from Concord Township, and you're going to be representing. I love it. And that's 5:30 in the morning?
Well, we are also to get together then, but the march starts later on, but it goes all through the day. The full march is 26 miles. We're going to be working on 3 to 4 miles.
Oh, wow. Well, that's great.
Probably about the speed of traffic.
Have a great time, and I hope you meet some wonderful people there. Thanks, Stephen, for calling in. I'm going to quickly go through a few emails in this couple minutes we have from Penelope. Spirits Alive at Eastern Cemetery and Maine Historical Society invite listeners to a fun celebration of Revere's Ride Friday at 7 p.m., and that's, let's see here, at the Cemetery Gates, 224 Congress Street, free and welcome to all. And let's see here. I had another one. Let's see. I'm sure you'll be mentioning the Margaretta Fair on the show today. I want your listeners to know that the Five Town CSD, Adult Education in Rockport, is offering a trip to Machias on July 15th, where our first stop is a tour of the Burnham Tavern, where the Patriots hatched their plot against the British after they learned about Lexington and Concord. And she says that more information can be found at fivetowns.maineadulted.org. We have about a minute left. Jonathan, what are you going to be doing Friday night and Saturday?
I will also be in Lexington and Concord as part of the commemorations of the 250th, going up with the Army Center of Military History. We will have booths in both Lexington and Concord. So if you're in Lexington, stop by Lexington Green. We'll be right next to the tavern there. It's going to be a busy weekend, a lot going on. I anticipate traffic will be blocked up for many miles.
And Tiffany, you hinted at this, but Maine Historical Society will have an exhibit next year.
Yes, so we will be opening an exhibit about the American Revolution and how Maine experienced that event. That will open in March and run through the end of 2026.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both so much for joining us today on Maine Calling. We learned so much and had a good time. That was Tiffany Link, Collections Curator with the Maine Historical Society. Also with us, Major Jonathan Bratton, an author, Maine Army National Guard historian, currently on assignment to the U.S. Army in Washington, D.C. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy, and Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, for National Poetry Month, we talk about innovative poets with ties to Maine. These are current poets. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.